Penguin Random House Audio presents American Dialogue, The Founders and Us, by Joseph J. Ellis, read for you by Arthur Morey. In memory of Elting Morrison, who trusted his questions and his students with a graceful patience I always admired but never achieved. This is probably all one can ask of history, and the history of ideas in particular, not to resolve issues, but to raise the level of the debate. Albert O. Hirschman, The Passions and the Interests, Arguments for Capitalism Before Its Triumph, 1977. So we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past. F. Scott Fitzgerald, The Great Gatsby, 1925. Preface. My self-evident truth. History is always unfinished in the sense that the future always uses its past in new ways. Peter Gay, Style in History, 1974. Self-evident truths are especially alluring because, by definition, no one needs to explain why they are true. The most famous example of this lovely paradox, which gave the term its name, is the second paragraph in the Declaration of Independence. That is, we hold these truths to be self-evident, where Thomas Jefferson surreptitiously embedded the creedal statement of the American promise. The ironies abound, since Jefferson almost certainly did not know he was drafting the American Creed, and subsequent generations worshipped his words for reasons different than he intended. Moreover, his initial draft described the truths as sacred and undeniable, and it was probably Benjamin Franklin who suggested the change to self-evident. But in the end, such nettlesome details have proven powerless against the sweeping influence of Jefferson's message, which defined the terms of the liberal tradition in American history. My professional life as a writer and teacher of American history has been informed by another self-evident truth. As I try to put it into words, I worry that the very act of self-conscious articulation might drain away the unconscious magic of my working assumption and expose it as an illusion. But let me try. It goes like this. The study of history is an ongoing conversation between past and present from which we all have much to learn. There, having said it, I can see that the formulation is helpfully vague. It does not dictate what we can learn and therefore casts a wide net that gathers in a messy variety of both personal and public lessons. Most of my experience comes from 40-plus years of teaching in a liberal arts college, where there is less distance between students and faculty. In such schools, communication does not end with graduation, but lives on in a feedback loop about the relevance and irrelevance of what had been learned years ago. The dominant pattern was a random and wholly unpredictable kind of relevance. There was the Chinese student who had done a research paper for me on the Massachusetts Constitution, which was drafted single-handedly by John Adams. This served as the inspiration, so she claimed, for her work back in Shanghai, writing a putative constitution for post-communist China. At her 25th reunion, another student told me that her career as a corporate executive had been influenced by two lectures on the Civil War, one from the Northern, the other from the Southern perspective, which helped her to think ironically. Several former students, both women and men, reported that their efforts to negotiate the inescapable tension between career and family were informed by their reading of Abigail Adams's letters, citing most especially her indomitable resilience. Such examples suggest that I was not completely fooling myself in believing that history has something to teach us all, even though it is impossible to know at the moment of learning just what that something might be. Self-conscious attempts to teach or preach relevance in history are therefore unnecessary, because the connection between then and now is embedded in the enterprise, fated to emerge in the future in unforeseeable ways. In that sense, reading history is like expanding your memory further back in time, and the more history you learn, the the larger the memory bank you can draw on when life takes a turn for which you were otherwise unprepared. Obviously, a few reassuring testimonials from former students do not a compelling case make. But since my belief in history's utility was an unquestioned article of faith, it did not require overwhelming evidence, only sufficient support to sustain its credibility. And on that score, the historical record provided several dramatic illustrations of a usable past that caught my eye. My two favorite examples featured John Adams during the American Revolution and Abraham Lincoln on the issue of slavery. In June 1776, Adams wrote to several friends in Boston, asking them to scour the Harvard Library for books on military history, especially accounts of the Peloponnesian and Punic Wars. He had just been appointed head of the Board of War and Ordnance, effectively making him Secretary of War, a post for which he freely admitted he was wholly unprepared. He decided to give himself a crash course on how to manage an army. Over the ensuing months, he bombarded George Washington and the general officers of the Continental Army with advice gleaned from his reading. His most relevant strategic suggestion, which was based on his analysis of the battles between Thebes and Sparta, as recorded by Thucydides, was to adopt a defensive strategy, what he called a war of posts. Much like the Spartans, Adams argued, the British were virtually invincible on a conventional battlefield, so the Continental Army should engage only when it enjoyed tactical superiority in numbers or terrain. Such advice cut against all of Washington's aggressive instincts, but he eventually, if reluctantly, embraced it. The result was a protracted war that the British had to win, while the Americans had only not to lose. This proved a more attainable goal, eventually achieved when the British abandoned the conflict after the Battle of Yorktown in 1781. In 1858, Abraham Lincoln also began a research project, in his case focused on the records of the Constitutional Convention and the early histories of that seminal event. Lincoln's research was prompted by the landmark Supreme Court decision Dred Scott v. Sanford, 1857, in which Chief Justice Roger Taney, writing for the majority, ruled that the framers of the Constitution regarded slaves as property rather than persons, meaning that slave owners could not be deprived of their property without their consent, which led to the conclusion that any law prohibiting slavery in the Western territories was unconstitutional. Lincoln's reading of history led him to a dramatically different conclusion, namely that many of the founders sought to limit slavery's expansion, a view he presented in its fullest form in his Cooper Union Address, 1860. He discovered that 21 of the 39 signers of the Constitution were on record for banning or restricting slavery in the territories. Both Washington and Jefferson, as well as 16 signers, endorsed the Northwest Ordinance, which prohibited slavery north of the Ohio River. Jefferson had even wanted to ban slavery in all the new territories. As for the larger question of slavery itself, Lincoln argued that the founding generation regarded it as a moral embarrassment that clearly defied the principles announced in the Declaration of Independence, which was the major reason the delegates in Philadelphia refused to permit the toxic term to contaminate the language of the Constitution. As Lincoln described them, the founders thought of slavery as a cancer they could not surgically remove without killing the infant American Republic in the cradle. Throughout the trials and tribulations of America's bloodiest war, Lincoln maintained he was acting as the agent of the founding generation, so that the Union cause spoke for the true meaning of the American Revolution. It is worth noting that both Adams and Lincoln went back to the past with explicit political agendas, which is to say that they knew what they were looking for. So, for that matter, did Chief Justice Taney, who harbored a pro-slavery agenda. By definition, all efforts to harvest the accumulated wisdom of the past must begin from a location in the present, so the questions posed of the past are inevitably shaped, either consciously or unconsciously, by the historical context in which they are asked. Unlike my former students, who discovered relevant historical insights later in life, almost accidentally.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?